This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 60th in a series of interviews with security gurus, which means we have been doing this for exactly 5 years. And we're pleased to have with us today, Neil Daswani. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Neil Daswani is the CTO and co-founder of Dacient. In the past, Neil has served in a number of roles at Google, most importantly, in my opinion, as part of Google's software security group. Neil has also worked for Docomo USA Labs, Yodlee, and Belcore. Neil co-founded the Stanford Center for Professional Development Software Security Certification Program, and he has a PhD in computer science from Stanford and a bachelor with honors from Columbia. Neil recently became a new father. Congratulations to that, Neil. So his sleep deprivation days have just begun. He used to have enough time
in the middle.
That's right. He used to have enough time to write books such as The Foundations of Security, What Every Programmer Needs to Know About Security with Anita Kasavin, I guess it is. But now there's no time for that anymore.
Okay.
So thanks
and for Christoph Kern. Christoph Kern also helped with the book.
I see. I didn't know that. So thanks for joining us today.
Very welcome, and I will work to keep myself awake during the interview. And,
just poke yourself with a pin.
For some of the Orient as well.
So you were very active in software security before you started Dacient. And I'm wondering, how has your background in software security and knowing how to talk to developers about security informed product development at Dacient?
Well, you know, I had been involved in, traditional software security as well as web software security. And, you know, there's been a whole bunch of threats that have specifically impacted web applications more so than other types of threats. And so, you know, in our product development at Dacient, we do have a number of software development lifecycle processes in place, ranging from when product requirements are put together, we figure out what are the security risks, what's the threat model, what kind of mitigations we need to put in place when we put out new products and features, and run that through the design, through the implementation stages, and out to operations, make sure that appropriate processes then get put in place, because even once you build in the appropriate crypto protections and security software features, all kinds of fun stuff will happen once it's in production. So so we do employ those sorts of techniques, and that background has been very useful, both in our product development here as well as when we talk to customers. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that we emphasize is that you can do as much as possible to prevent, and as security professionals we have a core that encourages us to prevent, but as per defense in depth, it's simply impossible to prevent certain kinds of attacks, and when attacks do occur, it's important to have measures in place so that the attacks can be detected, contained, and recovered from in a expedient, efficient fashion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting to have a brand new startup focusing on thinking about security in the product development lifecycle. I would say that's rare. And the question is, is it sometimes a challenge to try to work with the speed that you need to work with and hit the window of opportunity and also get security done at the same time? Do you have to really think about those trade-offs, or are they sort of more natural if you just do it?
No, I absolutely think you need to think about the trade-offs. And, if you're defending Fort Knox, you need Fort Knox defenses. On day one, though, you're probably not defending Fort Knox, and so it doesn't make sense to put Fort Knox defenses. But what's important, especially as a security company, you need to practice what you preach, and it's important to put in, good enough or a little bit better than good enough defenses in place so that you're defending yourselves and you're defending your customers and their data. When we work with our customers, we also go through security reviews with them. So it's important that they see all the appropriate defenses that are being put in place. One of the things that I've been glad to see is that larger companies that work with us do spend that time getting to know what we do on security, and we mm-hmm. do get a chance to exchange best practices. And
so they're asking that, you about that explicitly. That's nice.
Absolutely, which is different than maybe 10, 12 years ago. So it's good to see that progression in the field.
Yep. So you spent several years at Google, and some people say Google's kind of like a startup, or they would call it, quote, startup-like in some ways. Contrast Google and Google's culture with actually doing a real startup.
I would say that Google, in some ways, is a federation of startups. I would say that different groups within Google, are at different points along the startup lifecycle, right? If you look at things in the search and ad space at Google, they are much more mature than some new feature that Google rolls out as part of Google Labs. And when I was working together and leading part of the security team at Google, it was always important to have our team make sure that we understood, okay, where in the progression, is the particular group that we're working with to help secure. I think that there's some trade-offs. One of the advantages at Google is there's a lot of infrastructure. So as the particular startups within the federation of startups at Google progresses along, they can take advantage of a lot of infrastructure because it's there. With regards to doing an actual startup outside of Google, one thing that I should mention is that you have to build infrastructure along the way, but it's important to take advantage of existing infrastructure, even if it's outside the company. It doesn't make sense to try to build everything. You need to focus on what is your core, what is the key value prop that you bring to your customers, what are the key new pieces of security that you need to build, maybe build those internally, especially if it's critical to your core intellectual property, but work with other infrastructure providers and pay them so that you can take advantage of the more mature infrastructure so that you can offer services with solid security to your customers even though you don't have all that infrastructure internally.
Right. Your company is combating malicious code, especially what you call malvertising, and I like to call bad ads, and the kind of malware that works in drive-by downloads. So can you please explain the problem?
Sure. I'd be happy to talk about the problem. I think one of the big changes that's happened over the past 3 to 4 years is that the way that malware spreads on the internet has fundamentally changed. It used to be the case that most malware would come to you as attachments to email, at around that time or even before that, it used to try to take advantage of operating system vulnerabilities like CodeRandom, NIMDA, and spread in a worm-like fashion. Mm-hmm. But pretty much the way that malware is spreading these days is via the web, and it's taking advantage of various web channels. So you had mentioned drive-by downloads. In the case of drive-by downloads, the cyber criminals will infect a web page by taking advantage of some third-party widget that the web page uses, some third-party application that it uses, some third-party ad network that the web page uses, and send the malware through that channel. So the idea is once a user simply visits the infected web page, they will get malware sent down to their PC with no user interaction whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically with regards to the bad ads or the malvertising problem, the way this occurs is also manyfold. So there's a lot of very reputable ad networks out there. And because of the fact that a lot of online commerce relies on advertising and online advertising shows up on many sites, attackers have started using it more and more aggressively as a distribution platform for their malware. So what they will do is they will inject malware into the ad networks in a whole variety of ways, ranging from, you know, creating accounts, putting legitimate ads in there initially, and then substituting it out for, you know, what look like good ads, but also do drive-by downloads as part of it, and they'll do that on you know, Friday just before the weekend hits, and then you'll have a whole bunch of publisher sites that happen to be using that ad network, and you end up you know, can infect their users. As a result, those websites can get red screens of death shown when users come to the site, because you know, popular search engines and browsers keep lists of those sites that either are directly infected themselves or happen to be using third-party resources that have been compromised.
I see. So that's what people call the Google blacklist. I know the Google guys don't like to call it that, but that's what we all call it out here.
So Google provides a safe browsing API, which many browsers and other sources use, and basically it is a list of resources on the internet that have been infected, and in some sense one can call it a blacklist, you know, but at the same time they do a lot to provide many different options to users, to browser companies, to a whole bunch of consumers of that safe browsing API.
We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, you might check out my monthly security column on InformIT. I've collected all the columns I've written over the last 5 years on my website at sigital.com/GEM. Or you can do a quick search under security at InformIT. Thanks for listening. So, from a customer's perspective, what is it that you guys do exactly to stop this bad ad stuff and drive-by downloads through corrupted widgets and things like that? How does that work? And why, you know, what has that got to do with the end user with a browser?
Got it. So basically, when we work together with ad networks, for instance, we will be typically given access to their ad inventory, either any direct ad inventory that they have, or ad tags provided to them by some of their partners, and we employ very deep, quote-unquote, cloud-based server-side scanning of behavioral scanning of all those resources, and identify when there are malicious ad creatives that have been inserted into the network in a whole variety of ways. And you know, when we find such things, we generate automated alerts, and our systems, in some cases with our customers, interact with various APIs so that those malicious ads get taken out of circulation. It basically brings security to the online advertising ecosystem. With regards to what does this have to do with blacklists and such things, what can happen very often, even to large financial institutions like the London Stock Exchange. This just happened about 3-4 weeks ago. The London Stock Exchange happened to be showing ads on part of their site. And some of those ads came from an ad network that had malicious ads inserted into it. And so what happened is, of course, because the London Stock Exchange site can end up serving drive-by downloads through the ads, through the malicious ads that get shown on the site, they did get flagged by the Google Safe Browsing API and other sources as well.
Otherwise known as blacklisted.
And so, you know, when they realized the problem, they then, you know, took appropriate steps to mitigate. But ideally, you want to find out about, if you're a website and you're using an ad network or using third-party widgets or using third-party anything, you want to find out about these kinds of infections that are going to impact your site before the large search engines, before the large browser companies do. otherwise you stand to lose your users, lose your traffic, lose e-commerce revenue that comes into your site. So it's really critical to you know, security. When there was a security issue with a site, say 8-9 years ago, and the site got defaced or whatnot, I mean, it typically just used to be a nuisance.
Right.
But now there are very serious business ramifications.
Yeah, because it's actually going to the users of those sites and infecting them.
Right.
Or causing trouble for them as well. I mean, if it gets through the blacklist thing. So I have a question about that. You know, these bad ads, do they take advantage of vulnerabilities that are in, you know, the browsers of the people that are using the net? Is that basically how they work?
They do take advantage of vulnerabilities in the browsers. They take advantage of vulnerabilities in all kinds of third-party browser extensions.
Mm-hmm.
They take advantage of ActiveX controls. And so the typical way, once an attacker has introduced a malicious piece of JavaScript or a malicious iframe into a website, and this also happened, I mean, to the NASDAQ Director's Desk website, but basically, once this occurs, when a user visits the site, that piece of JavaScript or that iframe will, in an online real-time fashion, fingerprint the user's browser, fingerprint all the different third-party plugins that they happen to be using, whether they come from Adobe or where they come from, and figure out exactly which versions of those things are vulnerable. You know, it'll consult an online exploit database in real time,
mm-hmm.
and it'll figure out which shellcode to send down to take advantage of a buffer overflow.
So it's definitely targeted. Yeah, definitely targeted.
Definitely targeted, not only for users in general, but also, excuse me, also in terms of, you know, when the cyber criminals go for a website like the NASDAQ Director's Desk,
mm-hmm.
they are going after board members, CEOs,
right.
and all the information. Because once the malware is down there, as you know very well know, Gary, they will log all the credentials, the keystrokes that user enters. They will
steal
the information off their hard drive.
Yeah.
It's bad news.
So let me ask you this. You know, I can put on my purist hat and say, gosh, why don't we just build better software so that the targeting is either harder or impossible? And whenever I say that in public, of course, I get in trouble, as I did last week. And so I want to put that question to you. Why not attack this problem through better software security?
So I absolutely think we should attack the problem through better software security. I think the challenge is that there is so much software out there,
uh-huh.
And it is practically, from a practical standpoint, impossible to secure it at all. And so while we should build better software and we should lower the number of exploits that clients have, we have to keep in mind that the cyber criminal only needs one exploit on that client. And because of the fact that their tools are completely automated, we also need to employ defense in depth.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't simply rely on prevention. We can't simply rely on building better software. We also need to deploy countermeasures that will detect these issues when they occur, that will monitor important resources on the web for them, and that will contain and recover from these attacks in an automated way so that at least we keep up, if not stay ahead of the attackers. But just where we are right now is most organizations are in catch-up phase right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there are some leading organizations that that are you know, keeping par or ahead of the attackers, but we need to get more organizations into that camp.
So I want to push down the software security route a little bit based on some of your past work. You worked on this software security certification at Stanford, and I wonder, how does that work? Because I really kind of worry about these certifications, and I need you to convince me that that's not just crazy.
Sure. So let me actually talk a little bit about the motivation behind the software security certification program at Stanford. I think that one of the, you know, with regards to the goal of building better software, with regards to the goal of putting additional defenses in place, one of the things that I've noticed, maybe you've noticed as well, is that I also don't think we have enough security professionals
Yep.
in the field.
That's certainly the case.
Fight the cyber criminals right now.
Yeah.
And so part of the reason that we created the Software Security Certification Program at Stanford is to provide a career path for those folks that are not necessarily in security right now, but need to know more about security, to learn about it, and also for those folks that are interested in becoming security professionals. If your background is there, provide a path. One of the things that we did is, in addition to the foundational software security certification program we created at Stanford, we also created an advanced security certification program where we bring people up to speed on what are the emerging threats and defenses in the area. Mm-hmm. What does security mean for Web 2.0? What does security mean for managers of various kinds, whether they be project managers, whether they be product managers, etc. Mm-hmm. And so that's a little bit about the certification program and why it's there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of my concerns is that it's very hard to tell whether or not somebody can code if they're just taking some courses from you. That is, can code at all. And I suppose that the certification sort of purports that you can code and do it securely at the same time. Is that right?
Well, with Stanford's the security certification program, it caters to a number of different disciplines. And, I also think that while we do need more people that can code to help us fight security problems and build more secure software.
There's plenty more
there's
other
also
people.
There's a lot of other folks that need to help with the operational aspects, that need to help with the management aspects. And so, with the Stanford Security Certification Program, we don't just target people that can code and work to create software security coders. That's one area where we do need more people. But there's also just so many other disciplines that have to get involved to create a secure environment. Because as other folks have said, I think Bruce Schneier, for instance, said that security is very often a process and not simply a product. Right. And so in line with that thinking, we need to bring multiple disciplines into it.
So I want to go back to your Google days a little bit and think about the wars. Tell us a little bit about combating the clickbot.a thing at Google.
Oh, sure. Well, once online advertising became mainstream, cyber criminals started targeting online advertising, just like they're targeting social networking sites right now. Mm-hmm. And ClickBot A happened to be a botnet that grew to over 100,000 machines and was clicking on not only Google's ads, but ads of other ad networks as well. And so one of the things that we did at Google and that we published a paper around the anatomy of ClickBot A, which I think we published in Hotbots way back when. But one of the things that we seek to do with that paper is make the industry more aware of the click fraud and other related threats, because basically what the ClickBot A malware binary would do once it was on a user's machine is it would send a click once every hour or so on some ad on
just to generate revenue from the click through.
Exactly, that's right. And so while any particular bot probably didn't generate a lot of revenue, if you aggregate all of these things together, it could potentially generate revenue for the attacker, because they set up their own publisher sites where they get paid for these ad clicks. And Google took a very aggressive approach to dealing with click fraud, and basically said, we could try to put such folks in jail or whatnot, but a much more constructive way to deal with the problem from an economic perspective is to make the attacks economically unprofitable.
Mm-hmm.
And so a number of the defenses that Google has in place will make sure to identify clicks that might have fraudulent intent and simply not charge advertisers for them.
Right.
And as a result, click fraud still does occur, but it's much, much, much less profitable than when some of these things just came out. And I think, you know, the industry has done, you know, a decent job in putting defenses in place to mitigate threats due to click fraud.
Mm-hmm. So let's zoom way up over the Google software security approach and software engineering approach. In my view, the Google philosophy is pretty heavy on testing and penetration testing and regular white box testing, and there's a lot of testing. So I'm wondering why that is, why the emphasis on testing so much, and what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I guess you know, since 2008, I haven't you know, kept up as closely, but you know, I think that, you know, in the software world, testing is really important, right? If you look at mature software companies, they typically spend approximately in their engineering cycles, they spend about approximately half of it in development and half of it in testing. And mm-hmm. You know, in less mature organizations, they try to cut out the testing. I think that what one realizes over time is that you need to spend just as much or maybe even more time testing than actual development, simply because for each new line of code, the attack surface may increase you know, much more significantly than what you'd imagine just a typical line of code would. Mm-hmm. And so I think that you know, testing is really important. I think that the other nice thing about testing is that if you employ, you know, automated penetration testing as well as manual penetration testing, mm-hmm. What you can see is that if you run the automated tests and you don't see anything, well, it means that you should then progress to doing the manual testing. On the other hand, I think, Gary, you've also been a proponent of this, right, that if you run the automated tests and you start seeing you know, vulnerabilities come up, it means it's probably just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, the bar is really low, and you're just like whacking your head on the low bar, which is problematic.
Right. That's right. So, you know, you were asking earlier about well, can we code stuff securely? And we absolutely should invest in you know, secure software development. And I think, you know, part of that is also the testing, right? You can't just assume that you know, the design and implementation processes will go as you expect. You know, good engineers know that the only way to get validation is to test.
Right. Good answer. I think we're done with the technical questions. Now the most important question of all, what is your favorite sushi restaurant in the Bay Area and why?
Oh, boy. So I guess you may have read that I'm a big fan of sushi. I have a couple favorite sushi restaurants, but I'll mention just one. My wife and I live in San Jose, and there is a sushi restaurant called Tomo Sushi, which we're big fans of. In fact, in addition to Tomo, there's also another sushi restaurant that's much newer, that started by the same set of folks, called Bluefin Sushi. So those are my two favorite sushi restaurants. Why are they my two favorite? But part of this is historical. I guess with Tomo Sushi, my wife and I, when we first moved to the area, we used to go there very often, you know, a couple times a week, in fact, and it was kind of our comfort food sushi restaurant.
We used to go to Most people have macaroni and cheese, and you guys have sushi. I love it.
my wife is a very big sushi fan. She used to live in Japan, so yeah. We have mac and cheese sometimes too, though. and then with regards to Bluefin, that's the sushi restaurant that we go to when we want to go out for a nice dinner and not have just kind of your basic rolls. We want to have something a little nicer. So
very good.
Yeah. So thanks for asking me about sushi.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's really important information for our listeners there. So thanks for your time today, Neil. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The January-February issue of IEEE S&P features the engineering of secure systems as well as an interview with Paul Kotcher. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.